Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, sponsored by EarthX, the world's largest environmental experience, and also sponsored by Natural Awakenings magazine. Live your healthiest life on a healthier planet. Now here's your host, Bernice Butler.
Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today. We are now nearing the end of our fourth season, but we remain just as excited as ever to continue to help you explore and understand that unbreakable relationship between your health and the health of the planet. Here we look at the hottest topics related to our environment and its sustainability and how they affect your health and wellness as well as your day-to-day comings and goings. Here, issues like climate change, plastic pollution, extreme weather events, and others will meet up with everyday impacts like allergies and asthma, digestive issues and gut health, cancers, lung, heart issues, and more. So listen in today as we interview experts for today's show in our continuing August theme on why and how our transportation impacts climate change, looking at the role of transportation in air pollution. Now, transportation plays an indispensable role in our day-to-day lives. It helps our mobility. It connects us to the rest of the world. However, the convenience and benefits of modern-day transportation come at a cost to our planet, and ultimately a cost to our health. And so today we want to shed some substantial light, I hope, on the deep connection between transportation, climate change, and air pollution. And our aim is to sensitize each and every one of us about the importance of taking action to protect our environment and our well-being. Now, transportation is one of the largest sources of carbon pollution in the U.S. And carbon pollution from fossil fuels is rapidly changing our Earth's climate. The impacts of climate change, of course, include warming temperatures or global warming. It includes changes in precipitation patterns and levels. It includes increases in the frequency and or the intensity of some of the extreme weather events, many of us are experiencing some of that right now in terms of heat waves. And it also impacts causes rising sea levels. Now, these impacts threaten our health by affecting the food we eat, the water we drink, the air we breathe, and, of course, the weather that we experience, or should I say the weather we endure. The transportation sector is indeed one, if not the major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. And you remember, greenhouse gas is basically like you think of a greenhouse. You've got this plastic thing, and it's trapping the sunlight that has come in there, and it's causing moisture, which provides sustenance and helps the plants to grow. Now, when you look at that on the Earth's surface, it's a little bit different. Well, it's a lot different. So you think of the gases that we are emitting as a result of our activity are causing the shield around the Earth, and they are trapping, just like that plastic in a greenhouse, these gases are trapping gases, pollution, and other things here on Earth with us, and they're not allowed to escape, and that, again, is causing climate change. As we mentioned before, though, the primary drivers of climate change are many, but transportation and greenhouse gases are a major one. The combustion of fossil fuels, such as gasoline and diesel in cars, trucks, and airplanes, releases carbon dioxide. It releases methane and nitrous oxide into our atmosphere. And these greenhouse gases trap the heat in here with us, leading to a rise in global temperatures and various and sundry climate disruptions. And in our everyday lives, we rely heavily on personal vehicles for commuting and for transportation. So adopting sustainable alternatives such as carpooling or biking or using public transportation can indeed significantly reduce individual carbon footprints and help to alleviate the impact on climate change. But beyond contributing to climate change, transportation is a major source of air pollution, which has a direct and immediate impact on our health. Vehicle emissions release harmful pollutants, as we mentioned, probably the most prevalent of which is particulate matter. But we're also looking at nitrous oxides, sulfur dioxide, and volatile organic compounds, and carbon monoxide, all of these being released into the air, and the sun just puts them on steroids. Now, air pollution from transportation is a major contributor to pollution, as we mentioned. In fact, the transportation emits more than half of the nitrous oxides in our air. Studies have linked pollutants from vehicle exhaust to adverse impacts on nearly every organ in the body. And these pollutants can penetrate deep into our respiratory systems, causing or exacerbating respiratory conditions like asthma, bronchitis, and allergies. And last week we learned it even impacted the effect of COVID on certain individuals. Moreover, long-term exposure to transportation air pollution has been linked to cardiovascular diseases, reduced lung function, and even premature death. And in the United States, the transportation sector is responsible for about one-third of our country's climate-changing emissions. In California, transportation is the leading source of greenhouse gas pollution, accounting for about 40% of the state's emissions. And cars aren't the only vehicles that pollute. You've got airplanes, ships, and trains, which also produce a large portion of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. In fact, Yale Climate Connections asked the question, how can American society reconcile people's seemingly boundless love affair with their vehicles with the need to reduce carbon emissions? Also, it's crucial to recognize that the burden of transportation-related air pollution and its adverse health effects is often disproportionately borne by marginalized communities and low-income neighborhoods. And that's because these are frequently situated near major highways, near industrial sites, or airports, thereby exposing residents to higher levels of harmful emissions. However, while these vulnerable populations get the heaviest dose of air pollution, have no doubt, we all get a dose. A typical example is the Saharan red dust that we hear about most summers. We haven't heard about it yet here in Central Texas. But I know last year, I think we had two or three visitations. And just think about it. If that red dust can get all the way from the Saharan Desert in Africa over here to Boston, to Texas, to California, then by golly, that pollution from the zip code next door or across the street or the next county can certainly get to your house and to my house. So it makes a difference. So increasingly, it's coming for all of us. Another example that we've all recently come through, we hope, is the Canadian fires. As I was driving along, I think, Interstate 20 and 40 even, as far north as Washington, D.C., and sometimes in Atlanta, you could smell the smoke from the fires in Canada. So we all get it. So climate change is certainly expected to increase the frequency and the intensity of some extreme weather events, specifically heat waves, as we are experiencing here now in Central Texas and North Texas. Heat waves will likely be more severe. Sea level rise could amplify storm surges in coastal areas, and precipitation will likely be more intense, really, as we're seeing already. And these changes can increase the risk of delays, disruption, damage, and failure across our land-based, our air, and our marine transportation systems. And most transportation infrastructure being built now is expected to last for 50 years or longer. Therefore, it's important that we all understand how future climate and climate effects might affect these investments in the coming decade. Climate changes will likely impact roadways, ice roads, vehicles, and railways, and every other aspect of how we get to and from place to place. That is, it will impact them more because we really are already seeing significant impacts, just as many in the various places we live are seeing floods, snow, rain, melting ice. So our transportation choices do indeed have far-reaching implications for both the environment and for our health. And by recognizing the connection between transportation, climate change, and air pollution, and taking conscious and intentional actions in our everyday lives, then we as individuals can indeed play a significant role in safeguarding the planet for future generations. Now, this is a lot, but here today to help us unpack and understand this some more are two experts, and we hope they're going to make us smarter. Today we have with us Douglas Brugge. Douglas is professor of occupational and environmental health at the University of Connecticut, that is UConn, and he's chair of the Department of Public Health Sciences. And in the past, he was public health professor at Tufts University School of Medicine in Boston for about 25 years. Now, for the last 12 to 15 years, most of Doug's research and work has been about traffic-related ultrafine particles and their effect on the health of people living near highways. Doug's projects have been highly community participatory, and they have sought to communicate our knowledge to these communities so they can help themselves, as well as develop interventions and influence policy and practice to reduce risk from this particular toxin. Welcome, Doug. Did I get all of that right?
You did. Good to be here.
Thank you so much for making time. And our other guest is David Reichmuth. David is senior engineer in the Clean Transportation Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. David's work focuses on analyzing new vehicle technologies and advocating for policies that support the increased electrification of transportation. David is an expert on California's zero emission vehicles regulation, and before coming to the Union of Concerned Scientists, David worked for Sandia National Laboratories in Livermore, California, where he modeled the potential cost and benefits of the large-scale adoption of battery electric, hydrogen fuel cell electric, and improved petroleum-fueled vehicles. Welcome, David. Did I get all of that right?
Yes, you did. Thank you for having me today, Bernice.
Thank you both for being here, and we're going to go to break. And after we come back, David and Doug are just going to make us much smarter. Thank you. We want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Magazine, The Green Healthy and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all HEB stores, all natural grocers, all central markets, and sunflower shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Check them out. Our other sponsor is North Haven Gardens, serving the Metroplex since 1951, the most respected horticultural establishment in North Texas, offering gardening and plant education, concierge services, DIY classes, gifts, and more. Check them out at nhg.com. And our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care, practicing dentistry for over 38 years with a holistic approach looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at LynnDentalCare.com. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. To today's show on our series in Why Transportation Impacts Climate Change, looking at the role of transportation in air pollution. And we are back with Douglas Brigge, who is a professor of occupational and environmental health at UConn, and with David Reichmuth, who is with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Again, thank you all so much for making time to join us today. And I want to start out with you, Doug. Can you talk to us about what is the intersection of our air quality and our transportation, and why should people care about all these vehicles on the road?
Right. So especially in a highly developed country like the United States, a primary source of toxic air pollution is motor vehicles or transportation more generally. My work has been on motor vehicles on highways and major roadways, but it would extend to aircraft, to ships and trains and so forth. And the problem is the vast majority of these vehicles still today burn fossil fuel, gasoline, jet fuel, diesel, et cetera. And burning that fuel produces products that both drive climate forcing as well as produce toxic air pollutants that are hazardous to our health. And, you know, the toxic air pollution, which is my focus much more than climate change, really has two components. There's a local level of air pollution near highways, intersections, downwind from airports and so forth, that are primary pollutants that are toxic. And then there are secondary pollutants that form over much larger geographic areas, hundreds of kilometers, that spread, for example, I'm in the Northeast, spread over the Northeast and expose people in this area from a distance. As you mentioned, these pollutants could travel quite a long ways. And so for me, transportation is an important. Globally, there are many other concerns, burning coal, for example. But domestically in the U.S., I think a primary focus needs to be on transportation sources of air pollution.
And I've learned over the 4 years of doing this show, of course, that probably air quality or air pollution is local, as they say, or maybe regional.
Yeah, so I would say both. And a lot of our federal regulations regulate regional air pollution, mostly this fine particulate, PM2.5 particulates, which are regional pollutants. My area of study has been the local pollution, so I'm glad you mentioned that. Again, near highways, highly trafficked areas, there are greatly elevated levels of what I study, ultrafine particles, but also black carbon, oxides of nitrogen, which you mentioned. Carbon monoxide these days isn't so much of a concern. In the past, it was lead. Those are sort of pollutants from the past. But people living near highways, people driving on the highway in heavy traffic, people who just spend time there, maybe they don't live by the highway, but they work near it, or their job takes them onto the highway on a regular basis, are exposed to a plume of local pollution, which is unregulated and not studied as well as the regional, not studied as well in terms of the health impacts as the regional pollutants.
And David, want to talk with you about your work and what you see as the primary sources of global warming emissions in the U.S. and global, and why it's crucial to focus on reducing emissions from the vehicles that we drive. As Doug just indicated, again, it's kind of regional and it's local. But I have to think that when you look globally, everybody's experiencing maybe different things, but at the same time, some of the same things.
Yeah. So when we look at where global warming pollution is coming from in the United States, transportation is now the largest single source of global warming emissions in the U.S. And passenger vehicles are responsible for the majority of transportation global warming emissions in the U.S. So if we want to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, that's going to require the rapid reduction of emissions from the vehicles we drive. Now, there's also air pollution and global warming emissions from trucks, from trains and airplanes, but the largest single category is passenger vehicles, and that's why we need to really address the pollution from the cars that we drive in the United States. And it's something that we have maybe more direct control over. We obviously can set regulations for large trucks and for other vehicles, but we don't have direct control over, for example, the mail trucks, whether it's a gasoline or an electric mail truck. But we do have choices about how we get around, whether it's driving a gasoline car, driving an electric car, or switching out of a gasoline car altogether.
And I'm glad that you mentioned that, and I want to put a fine point on that, too. Again, that basically cars or vehicles are the largest emitter of air pollutants in the U.S., and most importantly, this is something that we all can impact or control to some level. Now, I know that we here in the United States have been more impacted by wildfires in the last few years than we were, say, 5 years ago or 4 years ago. I remember on one of my first shows, we had folks from the University of Queensland in Australia, and that's when they were getting the wildfire visitations. And it's interesting because they told me 4 years ago, they said, it's coming for y'all. And they explained it. I still didn't understand it, but it's here. So I do, I did believe it then, and I certainly believe it now. But the important thing is we don't have a lot of control over wildfires. But we do have a lot of control over the vehicles and the emissions that they're causing. So I think that's certainly important to talk about. So, David, though, while we're with you, how much do electric vehicles, though, contribute to reducing both global warming and harmful air pollution compared to the traditional gasoline-powered vehicles? Are there stats, estimates, or projections? When you line them up together,
that's a great question. It's a question I get a lot, and sort of like how clean are electric vehicles.
Or how much are they benefiting us, too? How clean they are, but again, sure. If we use them, what's that doing for us?
Yeah. So first, I mean, on the air pollution, you know, as Doug mentioned, that, you know, the combustion of gasoline and diesel has pollution that's just inherent with that combustion, both carbon dioxide fueling global warming and these other compounds that lead to air pollution and harmful health impacts. So when we look at going from burning gasoline to driving on electricity from the grid, that means that we can reduce the tailpipe emissions completely if we go to an all-electric vehicle. And then we can also reduce the global warming emissions. Now, the amount of reduction in global warming emissions depends on where we get the electricity from. So we are moving to more sustainable sources, more greener sources of electricity as we go to wind and solar and move away from higher emitting sources like coal. But, you know, that transition is underway, and there's certainly still emissions from electricity production. So part of my research at the Union of Concerned Scientists has been around looking at trying to compare apples to apples. What are the emissions from getting crude oil out of the ground, turning it into gasoline, getting that gasoline to a filling station, and then, of course, burning it in a gasoline car, and comparing that to all the steps required to generate electricity and the emissions from those steps and any losses in getting the electricity to the vehicle. And when you look at that, for driving the average electric vehicle in the United States based on where those vehicles are, on average, electric vehicles produce global warming emissions equal to an 88 mile per gallon gasoline car. So much cleaner than a gasoline car. Now, it's not zero emissions. It's zero tailpipe emissions. It's not zero emissions, though, for the entire recharging, but it's about half the emissions of a gasoline vehicle. And that's for the average electric vehicle. If you're really interested in reducing emissions, you know, there's driving a more efficient electric vehicle can reduce those emissions even further.
And your what you just talked about is looking at it basically end to end in terms of air pollution. But I want to back up for a moment and focus on what's coming out of that tailpipe. I have to think that is most of what's affecting us and affecting our health.
Yeah, Bernice, let me just add, David, that was a good summary. I appreciated what you said. There is one other nuance. If you're concerned about the local emissions, electric vehicles, as you said, David, do not have tailpipe emissions. They do continue to have some particulate emissions, and those are primarily from tire wear, brake wear, and lube oil. And again, it's dramatically less than with the tailpipe and the combustion going on. So it's a little parallel to what David was talking about with the climate forcing change emissions. But there is some, and I think the research is very early about how much remains when you get rid of all the tailpipe. But for people living right next to a major highway with a couple hundred thousand vehicles per day, there would still be a cloud of particles, albeit smaller and of different composition than with the tailpipe emissions, even if all of those vehicles were electric vehicles.
Indeed. Thank you. We're going to go to break now, but we will be right back on the other side to continue this very interesting conversation with Doug Brigge from UConn and David Reichmuth from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you all. You are making us smarter. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. To today's show on why our transportation impacts climate change, focusing in on the role of transportation in air pollution. And we are back with Professor Doug Brigge with the University of Connecticut, UConn, and with David Reichmuth with the Union of Concerned Scientists. And they really are making us smarter. So thank you all so very much for making time to join us today. I want to go back now to Doug. As we were talking, as the last segment ended, we were trying to get a sense of the comparison of air pollution of electric vehicles and the traditional gasoline vehicles. And what we learned is that the electric vehicles also do emit some air pollution. They're not zero air pollution, but it's far and above less pollution and less intrusive into our environmental quality than the traditional fossil fuel burning cars. But I want to focus now in with Doug on talk to us, though, about the major health risk associated with exposure to air pollution and where does it come from? I know that particulate matter is the new thing, or what we're finding out is perhaps one of the worst consequences. But can you just tell us about what the others are, and then we'll focus in on particulate matter?
Well, I think particulate matter is the focus, and I don't think it's that new. I think the ultrafine particles that I study are newer, but the fine particulate matter was regulated in the 1990s in the United States. And it was well established by then that it was responsible for significant health effects. In fact, globally, particulate matter is probably causes 4 to 5 million deaths a year and hundreds of millions of disability life years lost. It is one of the top five causes of death and illness in the world, up there with poor diet and smoking and so forth. I think it's underappreciated. People will name diet and physical activity and smoking rather quickly. They probably don't mention particulate matter air pollution that fast. And the other thing that is frequently not well understood is that most of the death, most of the illness is cardiovascular. So people think about respiratory effects, and if there are respiratory effects, I'm not saying there aren't. You mentioned asthma, I believe, in your intro, but also lung cancer and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. But the biggest chunk of effects and the biggest economic and mortality impacts are cardiovascular. And there is emerging evidence that these particles are also affecting the nervous system. I think that is less conclusive, but it's evolving. And the PM2.5, the 2.5 micron and smaller particulates, which are the ones that you can breathe deep into your lungs, have been the primary focus of research. But our teams, as well as others, have extended that to the tiniest of the tiniest particles, the ultrafine particles. And there's a growing evidence base that these particles are also quite toxic and represent an additional risk beyond the risk of the PM2.5. And let me just end my little monologue here with one disturbing, I think it's proven, about these ultrafine particles. When you breathe them in, they go to the back of your nose. There's the olfactory nerve that goes from the back of the nose into the brain, and these particles can travel up the olfactory nerve and deposit directly into your brain. So, and I'd like to mention that because I think it's disturbing, and it might get people's attention and bring more interest to bear on ultrafines, which are at this point not regulated at all.
I think, too, that most people don't identify or know or talk about ultrafine particles. They do know and they talk about air pollution. And I think there is a small movement now, though, toward recognizing the negative impact that it does have on one's health. But in your work, Doug, and just in your comings and goings, how do you see that we can get people to understand the substantial impact of the particulate matter and then the ultrafine particles? And how do people know when they've been exposed to it?
Well, that's part of the problem, is a level of PM2.5 or ultrafines that is detrimental to your health would not be obvious to you. It would not have a smell or a taste or a visual appearance. And so I think that is part of the problem with people thinking about particulate air pollution. I would say two things have brought more interest to this topic. One was COVID. People became much more concerned about what was in the air around them. They were wearing masks. They were putting air purifiers in their homes and so forth. And the other is these wildfires. The wildfire smoke is visible. You can smell it. You can taste it. You can see it. It lasts for a brief time. But here in the Northeast this summer, we've had three waves of very dense wildfire smoke coming down from Canada. I've lived here since 1982. I don't remember that ever happening before. And I think that, you know, I know that got the media's attention because I did a whole bunch of interviews and I hadn't done any interviews about the work I do for, you know, a year or two before the wildfire smoke. So the smoke isn't good, COVID isn't good, but it does sort of raise these issues, and maybe it makes people more aware.
It's unfortunate that we have to acknowledge that if there's one or two good things that came from COVID and the wildfires, it is an increase or a heightened awareness by everyday folks about the impact and the widespread pervasiveness of air quality degradation, and air pollution. So, you know how they say there's something good in everything? Well, we found that with those two. David, I want to go back to you. Now, we talked about the fact that transportation is the biggest source of air pollution in the U.S. How do other parts of the world look? What are some of the other big pollutants out there in other areas other than transportation like we have?
Well, I mean, where global warming and where air pollution comes from in different parts of the world. I mean, it does vary, especially on depending on where countries get their electric power from. Mm-hmm. In some parts of the world, how cooking is done, if you have, you know, indoor combustion, you know, for cooking or for heat. So that does vary. What we are seeing in general, just both in the U.S. and worldwide, is that for transportation is this really rapid transformation to where electrification was sort of seen as a possibility, to now seeing that as being sort of acknowledged by the global automakers. You know, we obviously have, you know, the big automakers in the U.S., Ford and General Motors, et cetera, but these are global companies, and you hear these companies talking about how they acknowledge that the future is electrification for on-road transportation. And you know, and that's not just in the U.S., that's worldwide. And in fact, other countries are actually moving ahead of us now in China and in Europe.
Indeed. I want to talk about that briefly, though, in terms of electric vehicle adoption. As you mentioned, globally, everybody's kind of accepted. Some of us talk about it more or less than others. Some countries talk about it more or less than others, and some countries have more or less resources dedicated than others. But how does it look in terms of adoption globally? What countries are moving ahead faster, and how do we get there?
Yeah, it really, I mean, it's the right now the regulations in the EU are pushing electrification a little bit harder than in the US, and then in countries like China, there is, you know, very much a top-down push to electrification, and it's supporting the industries like battery production, and that will drive that transformation. In the U.S., we have both the federal standards for vehicles, and in California and states that have adopted California's rules, there's these zero emission vehicles rules that are pushing electrification even further. And so that's what's happening. Now, if you look at the industry right now in the U.S., you know, California just hit in the first half of 2023, one in four new cars and trucks sold are plug-in vehicles.
Very good.
So, you know, that is a really rapid transformation. And in some counties, like Alameda County, where I'm talking to you from, it was over 40% of new vehicles were plug-in vehicles. So this transformation is happening. I think that when you look at this both in the U.S. and globally, it's really a question right now of not are we going to transform this from gasoline and diesel to electric vehicles. It's sort of how quickly can we do it. And I think from both a global warming and for the air pollution aspects that Doug mentioned, is that, you know, we really can't do this fast enough. We need to make this transformation as fast as possible. Some parts of the world, some parts of the U.S. are going faster, but we need to make sure that everyone, the rest of the U.S. catches up, and that so that everyone can reap the benefits of improved air quality and to try to limit the worst impacts of climate change.
Indeed. And I think we're beginning to see it. We're going to go ahead and go to break now. We'll be right back on the other side with Doug Briggy from the University of Connecticut and David Reichmuth with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thank you all. We'll be right back. We want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Magazine, the Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all HEB grocers, all natural grocers, all central markets, sunflower shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Our other sponsor is North Haven Gardens, serving the Metroplex since 1951, the most respected horticultural establishment in North Texas, offering gardening and plant education, concierge services, DIY classes, gifts, and more. Check them out at nhg.com. And our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care, practicing dentistry for over 38 years with a holistic approach looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at LynnDentalCare.com. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. To today's show on why our transportation impacts climate change, specifically looking at the role of transportation in air pollution. And we are back with Professor Doug Brigge with the University of Connecticut and with David Reichmuth with the Union of Concerned Scientists. And they really are making us smarter, not quite as smart as them, but it's helping. I want to go back now to you, Doug, to talk a little bit more about the toxicity of these ultrafine particles on human health. And want to look at what are some of the things that people can do to protect themselves from this and to protect their health and well-being. Because it seems like we can't avoid these particulates. We don't know necessarily, you know, I can't look and say, oh, they're, well, I think I can. When I'm behind a car and there's this big black plume of smoke, I know it. But that doesn't happen all the time and we're still getting it. So again, how can we protect our health and how can we help protect ourselves from these impacts?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the thing about ultrafines, besides not being able to see or smell them, is that they also change in space and time very rapidly. So if the temperature is different or the wind direction or wind speed is different, the level of traffic is different, then you'll get variable levels of ultrafine particles. So it is difficult. Some things are fairly obvious. I think the first level is I probably would not want to do my morning run on the downwind side of the highway on a colder day with a light wind blowing off the highway, for example. So there are some personal choices we could make, but that's difficult. If you're if you have to commute to work, you're going to be on the highway, you're going to be in that plume of ultrafines and other toxic soup during your commute. So, and if you live there, you're probably not going to stop living there. One of the things we have looked at a lot is air purifiers. I mentioned them earlier. We're running a clinical trial. It's our fourth attempt to work with air purifiers and get scientific evidence as to their efficacy for health. We and others have shown that having an air purifier will reduce the particles inside a room. That's not too difficult. But actually showing that it benefits people's health is harder, I think largely because people do a lot of things in their normal lives that they compromise the efficacy. They open the windows, they turn the air purifier off, they fry food and generate particles indoors, whatever it might be. So that's one thing. And then I think there are elements of urban design and building design that could also be, that can be and have been in some cases. I've worked with building projects. A school in Boston Chinatown is quite notable where they followed our advice. They're building right next to two major highways, 300 motor vehicle trips a day, and they're putting in a very effective ventilation system that recirculates air, pulls the air from an area farther from the highway, away from the traffic, and then has a high-quality filtration in the ventilation system. So I think those are all things that can be done. I wish the green building world would be more concerned about outdoor sources. It's been a gripe of mine for a long time that they tend to focus on indoor sources of chemical exposure. But near highways, the outdoor sources are a much bigger concern, in my opinion.
I want to go to David now. David, do you know if how we're doing with air filters in our transportation. You know, can cars, is there work being done so that the filtration system for the air inside of our cars can be better and perhaps protect us from some all of those black plumes that we can see and some of the other stuff that's out there?
Yeah. I mean, first, I mean, like, we've done, if you look at, like, what's coming out of the tailpipes, I mean, there is a little bit more we can do in terms of reducing tailpipe pollution. But we've pretty much done most of what we can do to eliminate the pollution coming from the vehicles in terms of technology, in terms of catalytic converters and particle filters. In terms of, like, the air filters and coming into the car, I mean, that is something that you can do. But, you know, in general, I think, as Doug mentioned, is sort of like we are, you know, a lot of this pollution is just product of the way our transportation system has developed, our land use choices, the choices we've made about our transportation infrastructure. And that is, there are absolutely things we can do that Doug mentioned, but there, you know, the solution really here is to reduce driving as much as we can, to reduce the pollution, and then switch from combustion to electric motors. I mean, those are the things that are the ultimate solution, that there are these things that we can do, like trying to filter the air, but getting rid of that pollution, because, you know, if you are standing waiting for the bus on a busy urban street, you don't really have the choice of what you're breathing in. You don't have the choice of whether that's an electric bus or a diesel bus that comes to pick you up, or whether it's a gasoline or electric mail truck that goes by, or all the other cars on the road. And so we need to really transform the environment that we live in. And we can do that. We have the technology, but we need to make sure that the regulations are in place that drive this transition to getting rid of tailpipe pollution as quickly as possible, and to invest in charging infrastructure so that more people can make that choice to switch to an electric vehicle, and make sure that we have these options that don't involve driving, like walking, biking, and public transit.
Yeah. Bernice, can I just add something? Because, David, I really agree with you. I just would add one thing. The train system in this country is woefully underdeveloped. And it was only when I started traveling to East Asia and to Europe that I realized what was possible. And, you know, my wife and I were in Japan in March, and we were in a train station in Yokohama, and there was a train coming and going every 30 seconds. There were thousands of people moving that way, and it was all efficient, all on time. And by comparison, you know, she lives in Manhattan, and I live up here, and so we take Amtrak. It's an embarrassment, frankly. We just have not invested in that kind of transportation infrastructure. Instead, we focused on cars and highways. I think it was a serious mistake, you know, 60, 70 years ago. I don't know how we get past it, David. Maybe you and your concerned scientists have some ideas, but wow, it would just be so much better to not have everyone driving all the time if we could.
And I think David actually mentioned earlier what some of the previous guests have talked about, and that's land use, because it's generally thought that a lot of the transportation benefits and assets that exist in Europe are really due to land use. They evolved due to land use as opposed to climate change and environmental considerations. But either way, it's a good thing. And that may be the lever, though, that we need to push more is land use in order for us to get our mass transportation up to par. But David, I do want to talk to you about what do you think we gain and where are we in terms of electrifying these larger vehicles, like the pickups, like the boats, the airplanes, and things of that nature?
Yeah, on the passenger vehicles, we are seeing more availability of larger electric vehicles. It's sort of like when people used to think of electric vehicles, I think when they, you know, 10 years ago, they thought maybe like a small hatchback, you know, it's a glorified golf cart. You know, that's not the case now. We have electric versions of the Ford F-150 pickup. And so that's great, because for people that actually need that utility, that vehicle, that there's a cleaner electric option, that's great. The downside is on the passenger vehicles that we are seeing this move to larger vehicles and less efficient vehicles. And so just because it's electric is not an excuse for somebody to go out and buy a Hummer, because you're going to see more emissions from that vehicle and other detrimental things. When you look beyond passenger vehicles to larger vehicles, There is the option. There is growing availability of electric options for delivery trucks, for even for larger trucks to go electric. And there's reduced global warming emissions for those vehicles, but also greatly reduced air pollution when we move away from diesel to electric vehicles. And so, you know, one of the things we've looked at here at the Union Concerned Scientists is that, like, you know, the Postal Service is redoing their vehicle fleet, and they have an incredible opportunity to go electric for those vehicles. Most of their vehicles go less than 70 miles a day. That they're driving through all of our communities, and they have the ability to go all electric for their delivery vehicles. And same with UPS and Amazon and all these other companies, there is the ability now to go electric, and we just need to make sure that those we have the right regulations and the right infrastructure in place to enable that to happen as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and that's my last question to you, David, and that is how are the economics stacking up? How's really briefly the cost of owning and operating EVs compared to the same sort of conventional gas-powered vehicles? Where are we with that? Because I think that's a big lever, too, cost.
Yeah, what we're seeing is that the initial cost of the vehicle for electric vehicles, whether it's passenger or these larger vehicles, is higher than the combustion vehicles. That difference has been greatly reduced by the Inflation Reduction Act, the federal incentives for both passenger and larger electric vehicles. And the cost to operate these vehicles is much less. It's fairly local, depending on where who provides your electricity, what that cost difference is. But the cost savings from moving from gasoline and diesel to electricity, can cut your costs. But it can be a third of the cost to refuel these vehicles.
Yeah, that can make a big, big difference, too, with people. Cost is one of those big levers. And I want to thank both of you all for being with us today. You indeed have made us smarter. We have been today with Professor Doug Brigge from UConn and David Reichmuth with the Union of Concerned Scientists. And they've made us smarter and help us to really understand some more that impact and that role that transportation is playing on air pollution as well as our health. So thank you all. We really appreciate it. We want to thank our audience for listening today, too, and we want to join you. We want the audience to join us, Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, in the Plastic Detox Challenge that we will tell you much more about it. But the point is to reduce your plastic use, to take small steps to avoid single-use plastics like bags, straws, bottles, and packaging. Again, more next week. But thank you for listening in today to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. Now, the conversation starts here, but our goal is for it to continue in your home, in your social circles, your workplaces, at the water cooler, and in the grocery checkout line, so that we can all work together to realize that healthy living is simply not possible without a healthy planet. Our culture is a result of a trillion tiny acts taken by billions of people every day like yourselves. And each of them can seem insignificant, but all of them add up one way or the other to the change that we each live through. This is your host, Bernice Butler. Join us again next week for more Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, and listen to any of our past shows on podcast wherever you get yours. Thank you.